Hey everyone, Raven here with another episode of Plants Save My Life. This week I sit down with Larry Norris and Carlos Plozola, founders of Decriminalize Nature. Decriminalize Nature is a national and local grassroots campaign to decriminalize and reschedule all naturally occurring entheogens. Today we'll be discussing their personal experiences with plant medicine, as well as the Decriminalize Nature mission. So join me as we welcome Larry and Carlos to the show. Also, a quick disclaimer, while I make every effort to broadcast correct information, I myself am still learning. I promise to double-check all my facts, but I realize that plant medicine is a constantly changing science and art. So the views and opinions expressed on this show are intended purely for educational and informative purposes. No topics are intended to be construed as medical advice. Well, I'm very excited to have you both, Carlos and Larry. I'm excited and honored to have this conversation with you guys. You are the co-founders of Decriminalized Nature, and what I love is that we all agree on the values of personal freedom and then the rights to have one's own relationship with nature. So if you don't mind, would you both introduce yourself to the listeners?
Well, sorry, Carlos Plozola. I'm one of the co-founders of Decriminalized Nature, and I'm here in Oakland. I have, by way of background, I have a bachelor's in biology and anthropology, a master's in environmental science, but I've worked most of my adult life either in social justice organizing, political organizing, and most recently being a housing builder.
Wow, yeah, it definitely would be enriching, not only going from like the organizing and advocacy side and social justice, but then even boots on the ground, housing builder.
Thank you, Carlos. Thank you, Raven, for having us on today. My name is Larry Norris. I am also the co-founder of Decriminalized Nature with Carlos. I have been very interested in plant medicines for a long time. I started becoming interested in them in late 90s when I went to school at the University of Michigan, studying cognitive psychology and biopsychology and cognitive science, I should say, which is kind of like pre-neuroscience, what they called it before then. I decided that that wasn't really helpful in terms of talking about some of these inner experiences, these profound experiences. You know, it wasn't just these mechanisms in the brain, but there's something else going on there. I was having some mushroom experience at the same time. Came across ayahuasca during this time, decided I wanted to do some research on that. So I wrote my PhD looking at ayahuasca and integration or meaning-making process. Also funded a nonprofit out here in the Bay Area that has been working with peer integration circles for about a decade. And now we're helping to, offer trainings to people across the U.S. That are building community alongside of some of the policy shifts that are happening related to decriminalized nature. And and then just kind of helping out with the national coordination, probably helping with about 60 different teams across the U.S. which are looking to pass decriminalized nature policy in their city.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, both Larry as well as Carlos. It's nice to know that you were able to take your neuroscience background. And like you said, at the current time, there wasn't really not only the vocabulary, but also the infrastructure to really describe these powerful transformative experiences. So it's interesting that you've been able to take your background and push more towards the advocacy of entheogens and the research of entheogens. And I would love to know kind of how you both ended up on this path working with plant medicine and entheogens in an advocacy fashion.
Well, for me, it was a long meandering path. So I was 48 the first time I did, which was a mushroom journey, was my first experience with entheogens, followed by a couple of ayahuasca and then more mushroom journeys, DMT, and then most recently peyote. So the long meandering path was that I have been on the healing path my whole life, and I would say since about age 7. When I had a profound experience with the death of a loved one who sort of sent me into a loop about the existence of the infinite and zero, infinite being, you know, someone said that they die and go to heaven, so forever. So I tried to understand what forever was, introduced me to the concept of the infinite. And then, of course, they died. So there was a concept of zero. And so what the hell are we? Somewhere between zero and the infinite. And it caused me any number of sleepless nights. For the next 16 years, I was really trying to figure it out. But the benefit of that was that it sort of put into perspective the mundane things of this existence aren't really all that important, I suppose, in the grand scheme of things, particularly trauma. that I went through. So I was very interested in what this life was about. So that was my process of going into biology and anthropology and environmental science. Always felt very connected to, with nature as a nurturing being that I was deeply attached to. Anyway, so I tried to heal from some of the trauma of my childhood and found my way into exercise, into education, into eventually yoga and meditation. Particularly after my mother passed in 2013. But wasn't until I had a mushroom journey in October 2018, that it sort of blew the lid off of my healing process when I became reconnected to the infinite in this more cognizant way. And so that really introduced me to the power of these plant medicines to help us expand our understanding of our own journey. So that's how I found my way onto this path. And then as I found my way onto the path, one of the things that I noticed was very few people were talking about how to ensure these remain accessible to the most marginalized in society, which is the community I come from. I come from farm workers who come from indigenous communities in Mexico, ancestrally, and the kind of the rural poor in Mexico. And so given that they were our ancestral medicines, that we used peyote, we used DMT, that we used mushrooms, they had been lost to our society, to our communities, because of colonization and oppression and then the war on drugs. And so beginning to understand that not only were they our traditional medicines, but they had been taken from us, and that many of our people had suffered as a result of the struggles of being poor in America and being an immigrant in America. And so then it became my path to ensure that these medicines are liberated for not just, mainstream America, but most importantly for me is the most marginalized of America who deserve to live full lives just as much as anybody else.
Yeah, well said. I mean, that's a great way to put it. Not only did they help you deal with childhood trauma, which are really heavy concepts to think about, the infinite as well as like the null factor right there at age 7. That's a lot to really handle and a lot to comprehend. And then, 38 years later, 31 years later or so, being able to undergo a mushroom ceremony and really be able to grasp those feelings that you weren't able to hold on to and able to really comprehend at the time, I feel is really where the healing happens. And something else you said that I want to touch on is that you're still in your healing journey. And that's a misconception that I think we often have, is that healing is like a one and done, you're cured at some point. And for a lot of these things, it's a lifelong battle. We're always constantly learning. We're always constantly changing. And I think that kind of relates back to what you said regarding the indigenous tribes and the communities that really have been marginalized in terms of entheogenic use due to colonization or due to criminalization. These are still traumas, and these are still things that we have to work through on a global society level, not only on an individual level. So I definitely resonate with what you're saying.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate that.
No, thank you for sharing.
Yeah, for me, for my process, I kind of came across this as a younger individual, just kind of coming into life, and was lucky to meet up with somebody who, of course, has the perfect name for somebody that's going to show you the first mushroom experiences and how to do it in a good way. And her name was Phoenix. And so hello to Phoenix if you're listening to this. She was really like, hey, because at that time all my friends were going out and recreationally partying or whatever else, and not having super profound experiences. And she was really like, no, this is about closing your eyes and going inward and letting the experience kind of emerge from that. And that was really, at this age of my life, it was really profound too, to be like, wow, this whole inner world exists. And it's like I was saying, there's that cognitive dissonance with my neuroscience classes of seeing everything as like, oh, this is, neurochemistry in your brain, versus it being like, oh wow, this is this inner experience of consciousness. At that point in time, I was doing some animal research and realized, of course, connection to nature and we're all one. And why am I torturing these rats every day? So I had a little bit of crisis of identity there for a minute. I think that the mushrooms that I was taking at the time really were profound. And that really sort of started me on the path of realizing, like, you know, we need a space for people to be able to share experiences. Like Carlos said, it wasn't a lot, you know, especially in the late 90s, there's barely any research coming out, maybe just a little bit from Strassman in the mid 90s. And, you know, so people were still not talking about it. You had to go to kind of like those strange cafes late at night with all the artists to hear anything or find anyone to talk to about these unusual experiences. And so that was where I, you know, had this really profound experience one night. And I was walking around the city where I was at like 4 or 5 in the morning, just looking for anyone to talk to about it. Cause it was just so like, wow, what just happened? Like, I had no idea, you know, like how many times in my life I've said the words, you know, in terms of journey space, I had no idea. Right. And how profound that one little simple phrase is. I had no idea and how big it is. Right. And so to really come back and like start holding space for people for that kind of conversation. So how do we hold integration circles? How do we make meaning with each other? How do we gather in community? How do we share with peers, not like through a particular system of like necessarily therapy or this sort of medical model or clinical model, which is all mostly on mental health, which is also very important, but also some of the things about like, what does it mean to be in a space with no body and still moving? What does it mean about multidimensionality? And how does that relate to our consciousness? And how does that relate to our traumas and our issues and our challenges and things like that here? What does it mean that consciousness is so much bigger than we expected and we're told every day in society that it isn't? You know, like that's a pretty huge thing. Like we live in a world where most people don't even know that there's something just on the other side, you know, and how, without getting too weird about it, how easy it is to control a population when they don't know that exists on the other side, and which is your center or your source or your core connection, right? If you don't have that core connection, it's really easy to be manipulated or have sort of authoritarianism or totalitarianism tell you what to do, because you'd be like, you're looking for another authority instead of seeing yourself as the authority. And so I think that was really something that was really critical in my process, is just seeing like, oh, wait a second, I'm connected to source. Every one of us is connected to source, and every one of us has the opportunity to sort of live life or to have certain perspectives or to be able to learn from these inner perspectives that aren't coming from other places. And so so for me, it was both the process of healing and also the process of sort of societal cultural healing, of realizing like, hey, wait, there are other ways of knowing beyond sort of, can we measure it? Because we can't, no one knows how to measure this stuff yet, right? And so that puts us in an interesting, you know, conundrum, right? We have to sort of unpack or deconstruct our entire worldview just to allow the possibility of what these experiences show us to be understood. And I think that's really profound when we think about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is very profound whenever you think about it. I hope any listeners just take a second to digest that, because that's definitely a lot to think about. One thing that you mentioned that I really kind of consider anytime we talk about entheogens is that authoritarianism. I mean, I think the first time you try them, the second time you try them, you realize that there's an inner knowing that it's not dangerous because it's dangerous. It's not illegal because it's dangerous. It's illegal because it's dangerous for like those who are trying to control that inner authoritarians. And I think that that's a very, very powerful statement, one that really needs to sink in. And I'd love to hear how you were able to take these messages. Well, real quick, I want to say that I think that expansion of consciousness, kind of being able to explore our inner worlds and that deep introspection, oftentimes we hear these journeys whenever it's like a last case scenario, someone has been horrifically addicted to drugs, or they're on a slew of medications, or they have a life-altering injury or something like that has happened to them, or a really life-changing trauma. I think there's also the value in that deep introspective work as well, even if it's not prefaced with a medical need for it. So I always wanted to underline that and appreciate you sharing that honest, candid experience. And then with that said, I also want to ask about how you were able to take the peer-to-peer education model, being able to really communicate with others in a world where it wasn't necessarily, it was still very taboo. I mean, heck, we're still talking in the world of taboo. I would love to know how you were able to take that peer-to-peer education model and really get it on the streets as the groundwork behind Decriminalized Nature.
Well, we're seeing, and you know, when we started to, I had those experiences in 98, 99, roundabouts then, when I was like, wow, there needs to be something, but I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't know where to look for it. It was just like I wished I had it kind of thing, right? And it took me about another 12 years or so to really get into that space where I was like, oh, wait a second, you know, we are the change we wish to see in the world. Like, if we want to make something like that happen, let's do it. And it don't have to be, you know, specialists. We just have to be peers that have had experiences. You know, I talked to a lot of friends at the time, and I was like, would you rather go to a therapist who's had no experience, nothing against therapy, but just as an understanding, this is the conversation we're having, or with people that have had a lot of experience, but no therapy training? And, you know, everyone was like, well, when I'm talking about these experiences, I'd like to go to a place where other people are familiar with this inner space. And I think that's really important because, you know, at least when we were starting to do the integration circles, a lot of people were even concerned about like sharing some of the more unusual and strange and weird aspects of these experiences. Oh, you talk to entities, or, oh, you multidimensional space, or, oh, you had this insight of a past life. You know, that's like people writing notes and diagnosing you with XYZ that you need to get on some sort of medication and block all those feelings because those can't be real, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a lot of people that were coming to the circles at that point in time that were just looking for a way to talk to other people about these experiences without having to worry about being diagnosed or judged or medicated or what have you, right? And so that's kind of how that all started off. And then, you know, we really helped to encourage a lot of different groups, one in San Diego, one up actually that's doing great now in Portland. We had a chat with them before they started their work, and a bunch of other places across the U.S., and really encouraging getting integration as sort of normalizing integration or the meaning-making process, which is really about gathering community, sitting together and talking to them about consciousness or mental health or other ways, you know, spiritual experiences, all these different types of things, creativity, insights, all that stuff. So gathering community around that, I think, has been really helpful. When we started with Decrim Nature, we were actually, you know, meeting with Carlos at his spot to really create a healing center, you know, and then we started having this conversation about, you know, hey, can we change policy, right? And I'd never worked in policy at all, you know, before we even started this, Decrim Nature in Oakland. And it's been a really amazing growing process with that. But I think having these different communities all across the U.S., not necessarily started by us, but emerging underground communities that are there, you know, we kind of like were uncertain, you know, could we make this a thing nationwide? And we kind of put the risk out, or we took the risk of saying, you know, I bet there's all these communities out there that are ready to go, that are ready to make change happen, that are ready to take the integration or the meaning making of our experiences and turn it into implementation or policy change or shifts and transforming culture and consciousness in society. And that ended up being the case. And, you know, and that's why it's so beautiful to see so many different groups all across the U.S. But I think, you know, the grounding of destigmatization, the movement towards, you know, realizing that there's a grassroots movement there too. You know, a lot of the conversation has become medicalized or clinicalized. We're talking about FDA trials. I just saw something on CNN talking about synthetic magic mushrooms, et cetera, et cetera. People realize like, wait, you can grow your own plants. You know, okay, that's good that they're doing that. But at the end of the day, like, let's empower the individuals to know they can grow their own plants, grow their own mushrooms, and have their own experiences in the culturally relevant settings, something that's going to work for them, not something that they're kind of being stuck into a box. And so I think for me, I see, you know, a lot of that process around, in my process at least, a lot of me learning about integration, learning how to sit in community, learning how to share experiences with others, learning how to activate people when they're in that mindset of being like, hey, I really want to do something. I know that change needs to happen. I think that was really helpful, at least towards my movement towards Decrim Nature and, you know, meeting Carlos and everyone who had the policy expertise that could really help us along.
Yeah, I'll add to that. You know, when one of the reasons these plant medicines were so profound, other than its impact on my ability to heal myself, was an understanding of what they can do for society. So after, you know, 20 years of doing social justice, political organizing, and honestly getting a little, I guess, disillusioned with just the slow incremental process of political change, given that we're sort of constrained by human cognition and our understanding of what is real, and then we just tweak the margins, you know, Republicans and Democrats debating and tweaking margins while corporations are there sort of pulling strings behind the scenes and feeding everybody with contributions, and then they can only move so much on the margins. And seeing all of this, it was, I had reached a place where it was like, even though I'd learned a lot of the tools of creating social change and political change and ran campaigns and all that, it was like, you know, this is kind of, for me, not a great use of my life because I'm not seeing much change. And then you get someone like Obama comes in, makes all these great changes and everybody's inspired. And then you got a Trump that comes in and basically kills it all and then takes us back pre-Obama days, right? So then Obama is probably like, what the hell did I achieve? It all just got erased. And that happens locally in local politics as well. Like when we were organizing in local politics, we would do all these great things, set up all these great institutions in the city, and then someone, new mayor, comes in and just wipes it all out and then sets you back, right? So then it's just constant ebb and flow, and the gains are on the margins, very slow. But the needs of humanity, like, are so dire given, you know, the climate crisis and the rise of authoritarianism and all of the fear that's being propagated now with this collective consciousness we call the internet. and the way that people use that to engender more fear and division. So when I had this journey, I was like, after integration, which took some months, I was like, whoa, these are really incredible tools for humanity to awaken. And if you sort of think about politics or even the market forces as, even if you have a 5 to 10%, and you saw this in the election yesterday, if you have a 5 to 10% swing in awareness, in let's say compassion and the sense of interconnectedness, it has massive implications for change in national, state, and local politics. So then liberating these plant medicines and for people to engage with these plant medicines becomes paramount so that we can hurry up and course correct as humans and live from a place of interconnectedness, compassion, and understanding about how what I do impacts others, and move away from this fear-based ego that so many people live in. So that was kind of my other urgency for it. And what we've done to make these widely available is sort of, first of all, which is really a moment in time, as our being present in this moment when we can implement these types of principles. One is decentralization. So that was key for us, is share the power. Don't try to hoard the power and create some nonprofit that does all this fundraising where the executive director at the top controls everything, but rather just let everything loose and open source, right? Just give it away. If we truly believe this is going to help humanity, give it away. So we did that. And the other thing is transparency, recognizing that when people have suspicions about leadership, it can really erode the whole movement. We just, we share our finances. We're open, we're transparent. We speak our minds. We don't hide anything. And we want to make sure people know that to build trust with our community. That's been the principal basis of our movement. Organizing principles, if you will. And that's what's really enabled us to use the internet as a way of getting messaging out, but then to be able to link it to grassroots organizing, which is kind of the old school model, right? Get out and do something, rally at your city hall, bring your message to the steps of city hall, do a sit-in in your city council and ask them for a meeting. All of these connecting this new way of organizing with this traditional way of organizing is really what's enabled us to have so much success in such a short amount of time. And we think it is a new way of organizing, you know, for the emerging populations and cohorts to build upon what we've been able to do here with even new and better improved ways of organizing between the shared consciousness of social media and actual action steps in the community, like boots on the ground kind of organizing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think that's really well put, the way that you describe all the individual steps and also the principles behind decriminalized nature. I think that you and yourself and your background kind of learning the different tools of change and also causing you to confront all the different societal pitfalls that we've undergone in the past decades and everything, I think that provides a specific perspective on not only how to change policy, but where the policy really needs to be changed. And I love that psychedelics and entheogens, like you said, they really provide a potential to change things on a larger scale with all the different needs of humanity that need to be addressed in terms of inequity, all the different types of systemic racism and disenfranchisement, as far as like climate change and environmental control as well. There's just so many things that I believe that psychedelics, like your guys yourselves, believe that they can really help us confront those things and make change for the better as a society as a whole. And to piggyback off of what you both said regarding decentralization and transparency, you mentioned that as the central tenets of decriminalized nature. I'd love to hear more about the mission behind decriminalized nature and what those steps look like.
Yeah, so the mission, I don't know, let me see if I can pull up the exact wording here. Mission basically is to improve human health and well-being by educating the community about entheogenic plants and fungi and advocating and changing policy in their community. Now, what's important about that is that the first thing we're talking about really is, so here it is technically, to improve human health and well-being by decriminalizing and expanding access to entheogenic plants and fungi through political and community organizing, education, and advocacy. The education part is so important. You know, at the end of the day, if what we're doing is not passing in any cities, but there are now 150 new cities of communities that understand the healing potentials of entheogens, you know, sure, it'd be a bummer because they're not winning. You know, it's always fun to get everyone together to organize and to have that sort of moment of success, because, you know, then the education has worked. You know, it's like getting an A on your test, so to speak, right? But in terms of educating the population, I think that's really, really big. You know, letting people know that exists, letting people know that, as I mentioned earlier, that consciousness is bigger than just our brains, to letting people know that they have a connection to source themselves, to letting people know that these plants and mushrooms might have existed in their ancestral lineage, and to explore that. You know, we sort of get homogenized into these big groups of people without understanding that each nuanced, you know, ancestral path has, you know, different approaches, different cosmologies, different understandings of ritual and ceremony. And all that's really important for us to learn about our own lineages so that we can get a better understanding of ourselves and our ancestors. And so I think, you know, that's a really big part of our mission, is to really bring that education. And then the policy is the second part. If somebody out there, a listener or whatever, would like to reach out to us, please do so at our website, decriminalizednature.org, or our Instagram at decriminalizednature, or Twitter. We can talk about that later as well. But basically, the first step is just to kind of reach out to us. Then we have like an organizer's handbook we can send you. We have lots of resources, lots of information. And then we kind of go through and you know, step by step, try and help the individual in their city to, you know, make change happen. So what does that look like? You know, and what's I think is another beautiful part of this movement, and I think Carlos spoke this a little bit as well earlier, is that we're not just teaching people, not just educating about entheogens, not just changing policy around entheogens, but we've set up a system where now people can find a template to engage in direct democracy. You know, find a way to make any kind of change happen. Like, oh, I know how to write a resolution. I know what an ordinance is. I know how to do a ballot initiative. I know how to write this language. I know how to talk to my city council members. I know how to write letters of support, all these different types of things. So all different types of change can happen emerging from what we're doing here, really focusing on entheogens. So you know, we basically help people out. We give all those tools, as Carlos was saying, lots of different toolkits we have. And, you know, we'll meet up with people in the city council meetings and we'll kind of strategize best approaches. You know, some people, there's a lot of different people out there. And there's a lot of different benefits of entheogens, you know, and a lot of reasons to decriminalize, whether it be social justice or criminal justice, whether it be healing for the community, whether it be, you know, ancestral lineages, whether it be exploration and expansion of consciousness, all these different types of things. There's a lot of approaches. So we really basically help people strategize. How do we pitch this to your city council members? And at the end of the day, you know, what I've appreciated about this journey in terms of local politics versus sort of state and federal politics is, you know, it feels like local politics, there's actually a community there. You can see your city council member at the local coffee shop. You can see them, you know, picking up like our sponsor here, council member Nolgayo in Oakland. Dude, there's like a trash pickup all the time. You can join him for that and participate in that with them. You know, like they're also trying to help out the community. I think that's really helped with some of my disillusionment around the political process, realizing like, wait a second, okay, this local community here does care about the community. They are together on this. And then you can build allyships that'll help you get from the city to the state. So really kind of help you with all that process in terms of, you know, getting the word out, and then, you know, helping people build social media presence, as Carlos was saying, and, you know, helping to bring people. We get a lot of people who contact. So let's say, for example, you know, there's 10 people in Pittsburgh. We'd send everyone in Pittsburgh out to you and, you know, help you build that sort of community out there. So we're kind of like the beacon right now that everyone's kind of contacting, and then we kind of shuttle it back out, and that sort of so it's centralized, decentralized. There's a spot where everyone knows to go to, but then we like push that power back out into the community so that they can be empowered to do that locally.
Yeah, I think that's a good way. And like you mentioned, Decriminature not only has had success in certain cities being able to legalize entheogens or decriminalize entheogens, but also be able to provide these kind of underground communities of voice and have these conversations actually get to the forefront. And I think, like you said, education is incredibly paramount. I think I've learned that education is not only the best form of advocacy, but it's also the number one way to really destroy all the stigma out there. So I really admire what you guys are doing on the front of education. With that said, I think that Decriminalized Nature being able to provide the tools to all the organizers, as far as the organizer's guidebook, the communication templates, and all the policy strategizing, I think all those are very powerful tools. But I want to remind listeners that this is done on a local level. These are cities that are able to decriminalize this. And then from there, you can always grow up to the state level. And I'd love to hear more about the cities that you guys have had success in so far.
Well, I can speak to Oakland, which is where I'm more involved here locally in terms of local impact. So we decriminalized in June of 2019. So we have 3.5 years under our belt of experience. Yeah. And what we've seen since is that, so before that moment, no one talked about these except for very specific underground communities and a very, very, very small group relative to the whole population. What's emerged since is everybody talks about these now. It's just part of the conversation here in our city. You go to a pub and you're sitting at a table and you hear the people next to you talking about, they're looking for mushrooms. They just had a mushroom journey, whatever. And it's just become part of the background, the cultural fabric, which was the intention, right? Destigmatizing means you don't feel ashamed of speaking about these. And then the other really beautiful thing that's emerged is that a lot more people are cultivating. There's a lot of people teaching cultivation and a lot of people kind of sharing these medicines in community. So I heard a statistic that before June of 19, there was a couple of hundred people cultivating mushrooms, and now there's at least a couple thousand people. And that's particularly happening in the Black, Brown, immigrant, indigenous, in other words, in the low income communities. And a lot of the conversation now, even amongst some of the social justice organizers and leaders in our city, who really carry a lot of the trauma, right? Because they themselves often come from the trauma of oppression. But then the struggle is very difficult. There's very little funding for people who are trying to make a life by liberating others through social justice work. They have been engaged secret. Many of them have been engaged secretly in working with plant medicines for a long time, but now they get to share it with their community without the stigma. And then those people whom they're trying to serve and liberate, then they share, hey, you know, these things work. The last thing that's really come from this is when a city council steps up and says to the general public unanimously, we're going to decriminalize these because they heal, then it changes the perspective of what these plant medicines are, particularly in communities that have been on the losing side of the war on drugs. And because for them, as in my family, we saw these as, you know, the same thing as PCP and heroin and things that either got you killed or got you in prison or got you addicted and, you know, whatever. And so learning that these are healing medicines in Black, Brown, you know, marginalized communities is a huge important thing that enables the healing path to be open to a lot of people. And we've seen all that occur in a short time, but on the flip side, we haven't seen any, no emergencies, no public nuisances, no news reports about problematic behavior occurrences with these. So not to say that we won't hear those, and we have to be prepared because there will be those incidences. We have to hear them within context, right? We hear about horrible car crashes, but then we don't ban cars. So the thing here is to accept there will be problem situations, nuisances, emergencies that occur with these, but then we don't ban the whole thing. We learn from those experiences and we grow from those experiences. So that's the trajectory we're on here locally.
And from a national scale, I think we didn't really know when we were about to, we were just excited about Oakland, right? Okay, Denver's doing their thing because it's before, you know, we started having this conversation before Denver ended up passing. Oregon's going to do their thing. We're having a conversation about the difference between legalization and decriminalization. So initially we're like, okay, let's do Oakland, see how this goes. And, again, I think we were like, wow, this is actually possible, right? Because we were doing the education and people were sort of, hearing us and understanding the importance of this. And then right before we passed, we had another city that ended up contacting us, wanted to sponsor a resolution there. And like, oh, wow, this is actually super easy to just put into a template mode and send out to all different places. So that kind of started things. And so our first city after Oakland was Santa Cruz, and then Ann Arbor, Michigan. Actually, we had a moment in time with Chicago. I don't know if any of your listeners are from Chicago area, but there is somebody who was their first day on the job, and they clicked the button that said adopted, and so it had just gone through consent, the first step of the process. Everyone was like, oh my gosh, they decriminalized in Chicago. And so even though it was a mistake, it was kind of huge for the movement because everyone's like, oh wow, this is possible in like the third or fourth biggest city in the US. And what does this mean? Da, 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 da. And so it was a great mistake. So if that person's listening, thank you for making the mistake, because that helped. And I got people brought a lot of vibe, a lot of energy to this possibility in all different types of cities, you know? And then unfortunately with Chicago, as with many other places, COVID happened. So that's something we don't think about much as well, is that you know, we did all this, we've done 90% of the cities that passed, you know, during a pandemic, during lockdowns, during situations where, you know, it wasn't easy to just sit in the lobby and wait for somebody. You had to try and get, you know, meetings and Zoom calls and all that kind of thing. So to really see this movement developing in the process of all that other stuff going on, I think is pretty special too. I've even had people from multiple cities say, you know, during this time, this was really the only thing that gave me hope. You know, this is like, okay, this thing's happening. Let's try and at least, you know, everything else is kind of falling apart. You know, let's try and make something happen in terms of entheogenic plants and fungi. And so that's been really beautiful. Since then, I think, let's see, you know, Washington, D.C. had 76% voter approval. Detroit had 61% voter approval. A handful of cities in Michigan have passed, you know, whether it's full decrim or supportive of, which is one of the sounds Grand Rapids is something like that. There's a few towns in Massachusetts that have passed. And then just most recently, San Francisco ended up passing a resolution related to entheogenic policy as well. So that's been really great. And what's nice about San Francisco passing is now it kind of builds the Bay Area community so we can start having these bigger conversations. Maybe Carlos can speak to this about sort of this Go Local initiative or this idea of like, how do we bring, you know, these practices into community without being extracted out, like we're seeing with cannabis, where it goes all to these financial centers in Toronto or other places, but doesn't really stay local in the community. And so having, you know, cities in the Bay Area, two big cities in the Bay Area on point with this really means that we can start developing it. And then building those relationships with our city council, rather than just voting on a ballot initiative, is also important. Because if you just check yes or no on your ballot initiative, you know, what does that do? If you're building relationship with city council members, now they're like, okay, well, what's the next step? How do we work on this? How do we create policy related to this? And so I think that's been really beautiful to see. And I'll let Carlos speak a little bit more to the Go Local.
Yeah, so the Go Local idea is, so what we've done here in Oakland and are attempting to do in other cities is to lift criminal penalties, right? At least within your own police jurisdiction, you can safely engage in cultivating and sharing and being in ceremony with these, and you don't have to worry about your local police department raiding you or pulling you over and harassing you. But then it begs the question, okay, so then what in terms of exchange and in terms of commerce, not to be confused with profiteering? You know, once upon a time, pre-capitalism and pre-top-down command and control systems, we would have simply enabled the emergence of commerce in a natural, dynamic way in communities based on trade. But now we don't really have any examples of how that emerges from a non-top-down structure. So what we're left with is either acquiescing that, you know, corporate interests are going to pass something at the state or federal state level, like they did in cannabis, and then usurp all of the value that's created and suck it out into financial centers, or we can create our own models. And that's really what we're looking at here with San Francisco and Oakland, is saying, okay, if we were going to create our own system of exchange here, how would we do it in a way that enables the value creation to stay local? And that doesn't, again, necessarily mean profiteering. It could be exchanges, it could be co-ops, it could be nonprofits, whatever it is that emerges. But one of the things that we're now realizing we have to do is bring together the healers that are doing the work with the intention, who come from a place of compassion and holding space for people from a place of love, and let them help set the policies and frame the policies of this exchange, so that if people are cultivating or people are testing, people are fabricating whatever, elixirs or tinctures, whatever, teas, that they're serving the needs of the healing community, so that compassion is what's leading this policy formulation, not that greed that inevitably comes with emergence of a new industry, quote unquote industry, and then people are always trying to, you know, get theirs, and then that's where you open the door for corporate intervention. So what we're doing is letting the healers lead and working with them to help build this these policy frameworks that include stuff like, how do we rezone to enable cultivation in residential areas? How do we assign permit structures that support local commerce to emerge, and that keeps big companies out, you know, deep pockets out? And we've done that before in Oakland. We we fought against the Walmarts coming in to protect small business for like 25, 30 years until eventually people were just so demanding that we want a Walmart that we kind of had to let Walmart in as a council. But for 20 years or so, we kept Walmarts out because we understood they would destabilize small businesses. And so it's the same kind of thing we can do around local economy is build commerce that works for the local community, doesn't just extract from local community.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I mean, I come from the cannabis background. That's something that we see frequently is these kind of corporate lobbying groups that are able to pass policy that benefits them rather than smaller producers, rather than the local economy. And like you said, it's more just financial extraction than it is stimulating the actual local community who stays there. As far as like cultivating goes, testing goes, and formulation, I think it's important that our policy comes with a compassion first model, which was like, you know, that's the hope and the goal with all plant medicines. But as we're seeing with the cannabis industry, it's very much a profit first model, which is disheartening at best. I like to believe that plant spirits are very, very strong, and some, like tobacco, have been abused through time. Cannabis remains strong despite being slowly corrupted. I really believe that entheogens like ayahuasca or psilocybin or peyote, I really think that these master plants can't be corrupted like that. At least I hope. Maybe I'm being naive, but I really hope they can't be corrupted like that. I would love to hear both you guys' thoughts of how do you envision an ideal model in the future for entheogens and psychedelic medicine and plant medicines as a whole? Is it more like the resort model, a more strictly clinical model, or like a free market model?
If we consider a free market model, we have to be cognizant that we don't currently live in a free market. Those who have more are able to write the rules, and typically the rules favor those who have more. So if free market means leveling the playing field, then I would say that's definitely where we're at, where we create opportunities for people to engage in local commerce and exchange with these plant medicines. At the same time that, you know, a couple good theorists, one is Jeremy Rafkin, who talks about globalization. And then Tony Saba, who is with RethinkX, who's a global visionary on futurist. And they both recognize the disruption that comes from technology on the major sectors and how that kind of is pushing more of a local manufacturing type of model. At the same time that we have this global manufacturing model, rocket ships, computers, that kind of thing, that are a bit more sophisticated to create. But at the local soil economy level, there's absolutely no reason why we can't create local economy, and that's simply enabling that commerce to emerge. So I personally envision, and Larry may have a different perspective on this, but I personally envision a world where community has their own healing models, and you might have different healing models in a Black community that you have in a Brown community, that you have in Indigenous, that you have in a Jewish community, that you have in a wealthy community. And all of them could have different community-based models of healing, and they share and they teach each other. And from that emerges a higher level of intelligence of working with these plant medicines, and that they're connected then globally through the collective consciousness of the internet with other communities in the world. And so we're all learning together through this local-based ceremony and commerce and exchange and exchange of ideas globally. But on top of that, there will probably be and probably should be for those people who aren't comfortable in community because they've been so, I suppose, anxiety ridden with fear of stepping into a ceremony, that they probably need more of a therapeutic or possibly even a medical approach to these. But if it's healing first, that is therapy and medical being about healing as opposed to pharmaceutical profiteering, where doctors just become slingers of meds, of pharmaceutical products, then that could be a good thing because people have different entry points they can get into as they work their way back to personal sovereignty of their own healing process. I think that there is very little value in the profiteering approach to these plant medicines. So on the corporate profiteering side, which leads to things like really expensive retreats that only the extremely wealthy can afford, probably not a big need for those, so I'm not sure that I'm a big advocate of those. But the other models, I think, could all coexist in a good way.
Yeah, I would agree with what Carlos was saying there in terms of we're seeing now how this shakes out, and this is why we're seeing, I think, Oregon, a lot of places have opted out of what's going on in 109 because those retreat centers are luxury retreat centers, $5,000 to $7,000 per person. Who can afford that? That type of thing. So I think, you know, I see a world where we have as a culture and society become so mature about these that we could have sacred plants and mushrooms growing everywhere. And it wouldn't be an issue. You know, there would be no concern about like, oh, what about, you know, the children or what about this, that, and the other? Because we'd understand these are sacred plants. These are sacred mushrooms. And, you know, these are to be, received in reverence, so to speak, right? And I think, maybe an interim spot between us, you know, just going and spore printing everywhere, spore spraying everywhere, right, is the idea of collectives. Or, you know, I have this idea of like a, you know, plant mushroom library, trade a spore, leave a spore, grab a cutting, take a cutting, that type of thing. You know, people are learning education there, learning about the plants and mushrooms, really encouraging that growing process and, you know, reconnection to nature. Collectives are really, I think, a great idea, you know, some way that somebody that's maybe really great at mushroom growing, for example, and there's, you know, somebody we hear this all the time, somebody that's maybe an elder and doesn't just have the time or energy or green thumb to be able to do any of that kind of stuff, can still find community, can still connect, you know, because you don't want to necessarily have that elder also just having experience by themselves and don't have anyone to connect with, right? So to keep building the community that way through some sort of collective or sort of library, that type of thing. I think another thing that's important too is the idea of, you know, Carlos was speaking to this about these sort of culturally relevant settings and letting culture emerge, is that there's a difference between sitting and guiding and facilitating and being a medicine person or a shaman or a matakame or a taita or what have you, somebody that's doing kind of more of the spiritual experience, you know, and then making sure that everything's safe and doing that sort of spiritual type healing. Each of those is going to be different, you know, and I think, you know, sitting is basically like, I'm going to make sure this person has water if they need it and they don't bump their head, right? You know, facilitation is a little different, you know, guiding is a little different, that type of thing. So I think depending upon where people are at, you can have these different approaches, different varieties of approaches. And, you know, as Carlos said, there are people that the only way they're going to really experience these is through a clinical or medical model, because that's, you know, that's their paradigm. You know, there's this idea of the, you know, the cycle pump, if you will, or like the idea of like the costume creates the set and setting for the individual to have this experience. And for some people, that is kind of like a traditional sort of garb. For other people, it's a stethoscope and a white coat. You know, for whatever reason, that's their cycle pump, right? That's the person that they've always been told is the healer. So if they don't get it through that person, but other people are like, they want to avoid that at all costs. I don't see myself, you know, drooling on a 5-gram mushroom experience on my doctor's office, messing up their tissue paper on their beds or whatever. And he comes in to listen to my heart or take notes on what I'm doing. That's not my approach to it, you know. And some people, you know, maybe that would work for them. So I think, you know, as we see these models, the biggest concern we have is, or at least that I have, is that, and I think Carlos speaks to this too, is making it so expensive that it's just not accessible. You know, this is a human right to explore your own consciousness. We believe it's an unalienable right to have your own relationship with nature. You know, and if we make it too expensive, we're just creating the same sort of, you know, income disparity, but consciousness disparity, you know, access to consciousness disparity, by putting value on it. And so that's what you're starting to see with some of these companies like Compass Pathways trying to do patenting and other things like that, you know, just trying to control the market. So, you know, some people say, well, why can't you all just get along? But when one group wants to monopolize and take total control, how do you get along with that? You know, there's like inherently they're excluding everyone else except for them, you know, to gain profit. And that's another thing too. I think, you know, I actually saw some interesting piece the other day that said like a good majority of the psychedelic companies that are on the market right now, or the stock market, have lost almost all their money, getting close to bankruptcy, all that kind of thing, or, you know, they're not doing well. And I think, you know, there's something about the marketplace, the stock market, that also just feels so, you know, icky to me. You know, it's like part of the market is to say, we're going to make profit at any cost. And if we don't, then our shareholders have the ability to get us out of here, get somebody else in there that can make money at any cost. And so then you see these high, you know, cutting corners, you see high costs for retreat centers, you see all these different things that maybe aren't thinking about the fact that it's a long-term process after your experience and takes integration and maybe takes 6 months to a year before people go into their next experience, right? And that's not a profiteering type approach. It's not like cannabis where someone might smoke 5 to 10 times a day. This is like maybe once every 6 months sometimes, or once a year as a check-in, that type of thing. And just to have that space for people to be able to come together naturally. And I think that's where like then the cultivation comes in, and then the community settings come into play, because that way, you know, if everyone knows how to grow, then those companies will be able to get a foothold anyway, you know, and then people can, you know, do how they want to experience the mushrooms. Some people want to pray over them. Some people want to sing songs over them. Some people want to just, you know, watch how they grow and learn about their personality, quote unquote, so to speak, you know? So I see a lot of different approaches to this. I think I'm in agreement. Once it becomes cost prohibitive, it's not good for anyone. I also am in agreement that, you know, people are offering services and skill sets, and perhaps those services and skill sets do require, you know, a little bit more, you know, exchange, you know, because somebody's really, really skilled in that and they need to pay their bills as well. But I think at the end of the day, when you're seeing $5,000 to $7,000 retreat centers out there, you know, or the FDA process, I have some people here in the San Francisco Bay Area. They were doing the phase 3 trials for MAPS with MDMA for somebody that's a younger person with PTSD. And they were charging upwards of $20,000 to $50,000 for them to participate in the study. And that's before it even gets FDA approved. And the response was, well, because the FDA has created so many hurdles for us, we have to hire all these people to do all these things and fill out all this paperwork and blah, blah, blah. So like just the FDA process, the system is cost prohibitive because it needs all these specific regulations. And then it's just too hard for people to do in sort of an inexpensive manner. Yet at the same time, you can go to Golden Gate Park and pick some of the mushrooms out of the ground and have an experience there for free, you know? So, you know, that's how that works. So, yeah, so I'm excited to see how this emerges. I think there's a lot of interesting sort of developments happening. And I think just like with cannabis, once you sort of decriminalize, you sort of create a setting where now there's innovation that can come to the surface, so to speak. Someone's like, oh yeah, I've been, you know, hiding in my, you know, garage, you know, all this time because I didn't want to get arrested, but I came up with this totally new technique that nobody's heard of before because I needed to use these things. And so, but necessity is a mother of invention, right? And so you have all these people coming together now that are sharing their innovations because there's decriminalized and because people are able to talk about it in a free way.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you both in the fact that having these multiple communities with their own methodologies and their own approaches to healing will definitely be the best model moving forward for entheogenic healthcare, or even just the expansion of consciousness. Because like what you said, making it cost prohibitive doesn't only create a healthcare disparity or a wealth disparity, it creates this consciousness disparity. And truthfully, that's a flooring thought. That's actually very scary whenever I think about it. And myself, I've also fantasized about just packing a bunch of spores into like a pesticide container and just coating the whole field. I feel like that would be so satisfying, and it'd be doing the good work for the world. I also wanted to ask, with your particular backgrounds, in terms of leveling the playing field, how can we all honor Indigenous communities and maintain that accessibility that's very important in these communities to those who really need it during this impending psychedelic renaissance? What do you think is the main objectives there to ensure that accessibility?
Would you elaborate a little bit when you say honoring Indigenous communities? What do you mean?
Yeah, like you said, in your particular background and in your ancestry, you have used psychedelics in terms of psilocybin, peyote. Many other tribes use, you know, ayahuasca. And I'm curious as to how we can move through the decriminalized nature model and ensure that there's correct homage and respect paid to those communities, and that, you know, either that be conservation efforts or that be restoring their Indigenous ritualistic and ceremonial efforts.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So are you familiar with the term Wetiko? Yeah. And I just came across this. Someone sent it to me recently and I was like, how did I not know this term before? It's such a useful, simple term. Wetiko is an Algonquian word, which I believe is the northeastern part of the US and lower Canada. Tribes that basically means it's a virus that infects us within our darkest spaces of our ego and then takes over as fear and greed. And it's in some, obviously it's metaphorical, but this is something that we all have now. We carry the virus because it's so ubiquitous in our society that to heal and not let it take over our ego, this fear, which leads to greed, which, you know, the sense of scarcity that I need to get mine, that takes daily work, right? Some people find it in meditation, in stillness, and whatever it is to sort of just heal the body and whatever, because you were always absorbing the virus through all forms of media. So I raise that because there's sort of two perspectives right now. I mean, there's many perspectives, but I'll simplify it with two major perspectives in terms of how to honor the Indigenous communities and worldviews that are out there. One is that view from the Wetiko, which is, you know, give money and let them, you know, there's some advocates who have partnered up with corporate interests within the indigenous communities, particularly Native American, small group within Native Americans who have formed a collaboration with profiteering corporate interests, who say, don't use plant medicines that have traditional, ancient traditional tribal histories. Well, if that's the case, that's every plant medicine out there. And the intention of that is control. And so we don't buy that because that isn't in the indigenous way. If we look at indigenous tribes from around the world, we have never tried to own or control a plant. We trade it. We traded plants. We traded minerals. We traded medicines. We traded foods. We traded artifacts with each other. And that's how humans became so interesting and diverse. So there's another path, though, which is more of the non-Wetiko, the more healed path, which is to honor the worldviews and to work in good relationship with those indigenous tribes, not from a place of ownership and control, but from a place of learning from and listening and learning from these ancient ways of doing things. And it's to honor the worldview, right? Because what's really fascinating for me anyways about the indigenous worldviews that still exist on this planet, that is the non-Western worldviews, is that is just how they see the world in such a different way, particularly in relationship to nature and to other living beings, and mountains as relatives, rivers as relatives, rocks as grandfathers. All of these carry really deep, profound meaning. And so I think the best way to honor the indigenous tribes in the world that have legacy with plant medicines is just learn from them if you do want to offer them reverence. And then, you know, if you're looking to become a healer, go study. And if you have some offerings, give the offerings. But it's not something that we can mandate. You can't mandate reverence on anybody. It has to come from inside, from a place of respect. And to do that, for people who begin to understand the power of these medicines, they will find their way towards reverence of ancient wisdom keepers much faster than if you mandate it, right? So that we encourage that path instead.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you're absolutely right there. We can't really mandate. There's no policies for reverence. So being able to build and respect the ancient wisdom and the relationship with nature and interconnectedness of one another that we learn from indigenous tribes, I think is the best way to pay reverence. I think you're absolutely right there. So another question I'd like to ask you guys, I mean, I would definitely want to be mindful of your time, but where can people find you online and where can they get involved on their own local level with Decriminalized Nature?
Yeah, so go to our website at decriminalizednature.org. I don't know, maybe put this in the sheets for the podcast as well. Our Instagram page is at Decriminalized Nature. Twitter account we have at Decrim Nature, and Facebook is also at Decriminalized Nature. So that's a way to see sort of some of the transparency that Carl was speaking to. We really tackle some tough issues sometimes, because it's important and we'd rather have that conversation out in the public. Some people are like, no, you can't say that publicly, you know, but at the same time, it's like, no, this is exactly where we need to say it. This is everyone's right to have this conversation. And it's even the same thing, even with like, you know, this idea of closed task forces. Why just put a small group of people that no one can communicate? Let's open up these task forces. So you can see a lot of the great conversation we're having there on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. Like I said, our website is a good way to contact us through that. You can contact us at our Gmail at decrimnature@gmail.com. And then we can start the process rolling in terms of getting you, ready to go. It's very possible. We also have a map on our website. If you go to the map on our website, you can see like, oh, okay, wait, there's a, you know, something happening in this town and we have a direct contact there. So if you want to contact somebody in, let's say, Missoula, Montana, or, you know, somewhere in Orlando, Florida, or somewhere in, you know, Austin, Texas, you know, all that kind of information's on there as well. And so they can contact directly. We always like to like say hello to everybody. So, that's a great way to sort of reach out to us at decrimnature at Gmail account, and we can kind of get you connected as well that way.
Well, thank you so much, Carlos and Larry, for coming on Plant Save My Life today. Thank you for sharing both of your individual stories of how entheogens have influenced you. But more importantly, thank you so much for doing like the good work on advocacy front, on the educational front, in getting entheogens decriminalized across the nation.
Thank you, Raven. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Raven. I just want to say, I think you're one of the best interviewers I've ever had interview me. So good job.
right, everyone, that's all we have for this week. You can find Larry, Carlos, and the Decriminalized Nature team online at decriminalizednature.org, located down in the show notes. As always, if you like this episode, please feel free to send it off to someone who you know would enjoy it. And we'd also be eternally grateful if you were to rate our podcast 5 stars and follow us wherever it is you get your shows. For questions, comments, and community, head over to our official Instagram at plantsavemylife.pod. Until next time, everyone, have a beautiful week. Oh, also, this is the last show of the year, so I hope you all have an awesome holiday season and a great new year.